You're listening to the Sportsman's Nation, brought to you by Exodus Trail Cameras. Now, if you guys aren't familiar with Exodus Trail Cameras, I'm going to recommend you go to their website. Tons of great information about their products, right? The cool part is they're turning four. They're having their fourth anniversary. And to celebrate, they are offering 25% off their Exodus Lift 2, their Trek, and their new solar panel. And this is running from May 15th to May 28th. They have a ton of great features, right? I don't have enough time to share all of those features in this little time frame that I have to talk about it. But here's what I'm going to tell you. I have a camera off their very first run, and it has not given me any problems at all, right? Put the SD card in, format the card, turn it on, and it takes pictures, period, right? And that's what we want trail cameras to do. They work every single time. Take advantage of this. 25% off. Go to their website, exodusoutdoorgear.com. Do some research about all the functionality of their cameras, right? You can take a look at their price. You can find the one that's right for you. You can enter the discount code YEAR4, Y-E-A-R, the number 4, and save 25%.
My name is Clay Newcomb, and I'm the host of the Bear Hunting Magazine podcast. I'll also be your host into the world of hunting, the icon of North American wilderness, the bear. We'll talk about tactics, gear, conservation, but we'll also bring you into some of the wildest country on the planet, chasing bear.
And then it comes at me again. I can hear it's chasing, it's coming at again. And this time the bear's head pops out of the brush right in front of me. And I am just screaming bloody murder. And I take my Maglite and I just smack that thing right in the bridge of the nose. That Maglite, like full hammer fist, like boom, right in the bridge of its nose.
We just got back from a do-it-yourself hunt in Montana. Colby Moorhead, the Bear Tech, and I just got back from an 11-day expedition out west where we traveled from northwest Arkansas, trailered two mules all the way to western Montana, hunted. We're going to do a series of podcasts that we're going to call the Montana Tour. And while we were en route to and fro, we recorded five podcasts with five different people that I think everybody's going to find really interesting. We also are going to be having, obviously, a couple of podcasts about our hunt and some of the challenges that we found, and also talking about exactly how everything went down. On this first Montana Tour episode, we are with my good friends Justin and Rebecca Spring near Missoula, Montana. Justin is the director of records for the Boone and Crockett Club. And we talk about some history of the Boone and Crockett Club, which is incredible stuff that every hunter needs to know. It doesn't matter if you like scoring or not. When you listen to this podcast, you're going to be surprised at what you hear and what you learn. But we also talk with Justin and Rebecca about some of their backcountry hunting for sure. They've done some incredible hunts, and they go into detail about their caribou Alaskan drop camp hunt that they did this last fall, and among many other things. But this is the first of the series, really entertaining, really full of some great information, and you're going to enjoy it. The other podcasts that we did that are going to be coming is we stopped at the Best of the West headquarters in Cody, Wyoming, and did a great podcast with Jim Sessions and Jared Peterson about what they do and some of their hunting and the long-range guns that they shoot and optics. Then we went and met with Joe Condellis of the Western Bear Foundation. Had an incredible conversation with him as he gave us an update on the grizzly bear situation there in Wyoming and Montana and Idaho, but also talked about spring black bear in the West. Really cool. Then we dropped down to Denver, and we met with Aaron Snyder, went to Kafaru International, and had about an hour and 20-minute long conversation with the infamous slash famous Aaron Snyder. Really neat, really fun, cool podcast that you're going to enjoy. Then we dove over in Denver as well and met with my good friend and Bear Hunting Magazine columnist and outdoor writer, Brian Strickland. And Brian just last week killed a Boone Crockett bear in Manitoba. And Brian transitioned to traditional archery over the last 5 years or so. And so we have a cool conversation with him about traditional archery, about bear hunting, about his history in the outdoor industry, and about the Boone and Crockett bear that he killed last week. You're going to enjoy this podcast with Justin Rebecca Spring. And I want to remind you of one thing. We set up a Bear Hunting Magazine Patreon account. And again, this Patreon is for the podcast and our YouTube channel. That's the idea, is that this is all free content and always will be. But we wanted to find a way for people to give back. There's two ways that you can give back if you enjoy the content we're creating. Is that you can subscribe to Bear Hunting Magazine, which that's an awesome thing to do. You're going to get something in your hands 6 times a year, a very high-quality publication, the only print bear hunting publication in the world. They've been in print for 20 years. So subscribe to Bear Hunting Magazine. If you're not interested in that and you want to contribute to the cause, then you can check out Patreon and you understand how that goes. So, hey, appreciate it. On to the Montana tour. You're going to want to listen to the end when Becca Spring tells about the time she punched a black bear in the face. I'm serious. You're going to want to hear it. She's live. Welcome to the Bear Hunting Magazine podcast. I am with Colby Moorhead, the Bear Tech, and we are in near Missoula, Montana. Let's not give away our coordinates too specifically, but we're near Missoula, Montana. And Colby and I have been in and out of backcountry for the last 6 days. We've been on a bear hunt. We're going to be talking about that bear hunt in some podcast, either before this podcast or after this podcast, not sure. But today we are going to have an awesome conversation with Justin and Rebecca Spring. Justin is the director of Big Game Records. Did I say it right?
That's correct.
For the Boone and Crockett Club. And Becca is his wife, and she has taught him everything that he knows about scoring animals, about conservation, about hunting, about being bad to the bone. Am I right?
Someone's got to do it.
Somebody's got no. So we're So on this podcast, I want to, if you haven't met Justin, he writes inside of the Boone and Crockett ethic.
They're Pope and Young ethic. Boone and Crockett's fair chase.
I'm sorry, Boone and Crockett. Edit that out. Mark that out. I'm just kidding. Yeah, that's right. Boone and Crockett Fair Chase Magazine. And so we're going to get into, Justin's going to talk about what he does, going to talk some about the Boone and Crockett Club, and Becca is here to pretty much keep us in line and give us all the hunting tidbit wisdom that she has to offer. Becca has been like the driving force of this hunt. You've been telling us pretty much where to go, what to do, how to do it. Is that right, Becca?
I don't know. You guys drug the critters all the way here and got on your feet and got out there. I just tried to provide a little food here and there, maybe.
Yeah. Yes. We've been treated very well. Incredible, incredible hospitality.
You guys are you going to introduce the world to Becca Bars?
Yes, for sure. That comes later.
Okay.
But, yeah, we'll talk about food. But, no, let's just start off with an introduction. Justin, tell us who you are. I know what you do, but just any way that you would describe yourself, go for it.
Okay, so I started for Boone and Crockett. Been about 10 years now that I've worked for them. People always ask me how I got the job. I actually drew a mountain goat tag in Oregon, and the vice president of records was at the orientation, so hunting got me into the job, and they haven't been able to get rid of me since. first 8 years, I was the assistant director of records, which means basically I reviewed every entry that comes in from all over North America. So we have 1,440 majors, give or take now, and everything that they score is reviewed individually in Missoula. And so, like I said, the first 8 years I was there, I was doing mainly review, and then stepped into the director's role a couple years ago. And now I'm, you know, as you said, write for the magazine, do the best I can to get the word out about Boone and Crockett, what we're doing, conservation, the success stories of everything, and even the negatives that we do see in our data set as well, some things that cause concern that as conservationists and hunters, we want to keep our eye on and make sure that it's nothing that we're doing wrong that's causing any right. negativity. So,
yeah. So you got real good at math for about 8 years then, huh?
I get real good at using the computer.
Yeah.
It's a lot of fun reviewing all these and just seeing, you know, people get really excited about world records and the biggest ever, you know, but we got to witness some pretty cool stuff, you know, especially, you know, in your world and bears. I mean, the certain states and whatnot showing up that we'd never seen before.
Right.
You know, and people get really hung up on rankings and numbers, but, you know, at the end of the day, it's gauging wildlife conservation successes and failures. And, you know, an entry from a new county is far more exciting to me than the biggest deer ever taken in Arkansas, for example, or something.
Right.
Just because of what we're trying to do and engage and new areas showing up means that wildlife conservation is working. Our success of
right.
North American model is desired effect.
That what you're saying right there almost has to be, you have to build up to it, because I don't think most hunters understand what the record keeping system was originally designed right. to do. Most people today view the records as just a way to gauge the size of an animal so that we can tell who's got the biggest one.
Right.
Basically. But when I, and let me give a little bit of personal history too. I became an official measurer in 2014 or something. And so I came to Missoula for the 3-day class, and that's where I met you and Becca. Right. And that class, for real, impacted me in a deep way, because I thought that we were going to go there to really learn the nitty-gritty, or the emphasis, because we did learn the nitty-gritty of how to score the North American big game. But I felt like that was going to be like the emphasis, like accuracy, get this right. But really the emphasis was conservation and understanding the whole – the macro picture of what the Boone and Crockett Club is and what its goals are and how the record-keeping system is actually a biological database to show us where stuff is working, where habitat is good, because I don't want to steal your...
Yeah, no, but you're doing great. I'm just...
Well, I mean, just to say it quickly, where there are older, mature males in a population, that means that something is going right from a habitat, from a hunting, from a conservation perspective. And so originally, the founders of the Boone and Crockett Club, their goal was to keep a biological record. And the best way they could figure to do it was to say, where are the older mature males? Yeah. And but I want to hear
well,
from you,
you know,
Justin.
We'll start from the beginning. You know, 1887, Theodore Roosevelt, our founding days, this was a time that wildlife was not, it wasn't going to be around. I mean,
right.
the bison were nearly extinct. Roosevelt came out west looking for a bison and barely found any. And they were, you know, they're collecting for the, you know, National Museum. And so what they did at the time, and the original purpose of records, was they wanted to get specimens to show our generations what once was in the North American continent.
They didn't think they were going to be here anymore.
100% thought that it was gone. I mean, the passenger pigeon, they'd seen it at that time, they'd seen it nearly decimated. It was 1913, the last one died, something like that. And they thought that was the future of all wildlife. So it was the Bronx Zoo, National Collection of Heads and Horns, was kind of our beginning. And they were looking for the largest specimen of every species, and it was actually the world at the time, to put on display so people could see what there once was. And that was 1905, I believe, is when that was opened.
So the club started in 1887.
Part of that was the Bronx Zoo some early club members, Madison Grant, folks like that, that were involved with the zoo that were trying to make this collection. And, you know, the original picture of the display says dedicated to the vanishing big game of the world. Wow. And that hung over the door when you walked into the National Collection, which was supposed to house the best of what was once here. So that's where they started out. They were building the collection. But at the same time, we started with game regulations. This idea of fair chase was something they promoted.
And which would have been a totally unheard of concept.
Oh, yeah.
Like today, the value of fair chase, whether anyone has ever heard of the Boone and Crockett Club or not, if you're a North American hunter, you live by, whether consciously or unconsciously, some ethic of fair chase inside of what you do.
Right.
I mean, most 99.9% of people. And that came from the Boone and Crockett Club in the late 1800s. Yep. That were coming from a market hunting mentality or a zero conservation-based mentality of market hunting for the last 150 years on this continent from Europeans, basically. And then, so they introduced this idea of fair chase, introduced this idea of to give some quantifiable measurements to older mature males, right, so that people would want to shoot a big old buck rather than shoot the doe or the juvenile or the small immature buck. I mean, they're the ones, and that's completely separate from the ideas of fair chase.
Yeah.
But, I mean, they're the ones that introduced this stuff.
Well, you know, it was different at the time. You know, Forest and Stream was the hunting magazine of the day. And there wasn't scientific journals. There was no field of wildlife management. And so the exchange of scientific ideas with wildlife, with these naturalists, took place in this Forest and Stream. George Bird Grinnell, who's probably the least known name, but every hunter should know. Roosevelt was very good at getting up and giving speeches and getting the crowd fired up.
Right.
Grinnell was the brains of the conservation movement.
Mm.
He and Roosevelt,
George Bird Grinnell,
worked very well together. But how this whole thing had started is Roosevelt had written an article about hunting that ran in the magazine or a book, excuse me, and Grinnell wrote a review of it, and it was not glowing. So TR was pretty mad, stomps down there, kicks down the door, goes in there and demands that, you know, Grinnell justify what he said. Well, this turns into the two of them finding out that they're both very passionate and seeing in each other what the conservation movement needed, and that is the beginning of Boone and Crockett, was that interaction. Mm. So in this beginning time, they've got this national collection that they're trying to build up for future generations, but they're also pushing the idea of fair chase. And the idea here was the hunting was an important part. It was the history, the rugged lifestyle that TR promoted. He wanted hunting to continue, but the practices of the day with market hunting, and another thing that a lot of people don't realize, but you read into it, is that they called them pot hunters or meat hunters. Nobody cared. It was just an unlimited resource. And so they brought in this idea of fair chase, of giving the animal a chance to escape. And it wasn't about quantity. It wasn't about filling the pot. It wasn't about feeding your family. It was going out and actively making it harder on yourself so that it wasn't guaranteed success.
Yeah.
And then concentrating your harvest on your older, mature males that have no net effect on the population if they're there or not.
Right.
And so, I mean, trophy hunting's got a horrible name today. But the original idea was if you shoot these old mature males, the population can recover, and it did. It worked phenomenally. We had game laws. We had the idea of never – I wasn't born until the 80s, but it was still my dad and his hunting buddies. You don't shoot does. That's wrong. Well, that idea all came from this original fair chase, and it's still around. And today, we're not there. I mean, basically, this was – in the beginning, this was necessary. Folks started to buy in. 1930, Aldo Leupold, University of Wisconsin Wildlife Management was born. And this was a time that fair chase kind of shifted gears. In the beginning, it was required to maintain populations. Once you started getting state management, we now have wildlife managers that say you can kill 10 does and a buck a year. you know, whatever it may be.
Right.
But fair chase is now, it's just the ethical, the way, the accepted way, the right way. If you're going to go out, you're going to hunt, you know, there's an ethic to it. It's not just killing. It's not indiscriminately killing. It's no unnecessary suffering. I mean, it's everything you can do to give the animal a fair chance,
right.
not guarantee success.
Right.
So, well, this is all happening. The National Collection kind of falls out of fashion. Nobody really cares anymore because you can now go to Yellowstone or, you know, these national parks and see these animals. And so the collection falls to the wayside, and the club had started to collect data, but they're like, well, we don't need to do this anymore. So in 1950, they redid the system. And that's when they really said, what are the traits of the most healthy animal? They used bilateral symmetry, left to right. It's common throughout nature. They also looked at mass, and they looked at time length.
Let me stop you right there and ask you a question about the transition that the club went through. So are you saying that from 1887 to 1930, when Leopold started writing, that there was a massive shift in the hunting culture?
Yep.
So that 43 years, I don't know, it would be give or take, but that's when something happened. How did these guys infiltrate that ethic into the hunting culture? Just through media?
Yeah.
I mean the media of the time, which would have been the newspapers magazine. And magazines.
Yep. And, you know, these prolific writers. You read back, and I've, you know, looking at the old entries and whatnot, we get them in, and you read these stories. And they shamed these people into feeling guilty if they were to take two moose instead of one in a lifetime. There's this
really?
Dahl DeWeese, who was there's a museum in Colorado that has a bunch of his trophies, and he hunted Alaska extensively, kind of brought the attention to what became some of the refuges up there.
Hmm.
And he was writing of a hunt on Tustamina Lake, which is a pretty awesome place on the peninsula up there. And he's in his writing, he's saying, you know you're going to call me a game hog because I've already killed a good moose. But this was the largest moose. Well, it turned out to be the largest moose ever. It was a world record.
Mm.
But he's justifying, like, shooting a second moose in his lifetime.
Wow.
And so somehow, and this was in the 20s, I believe. So somehow that became the trendy thing, is to not be a game hog, to enjoy hunting, you know,
yeah,
to concentrate on it. And they just swung popular opinion.
Yeah.
So it was pretty amazing. In the 30s is when it started. I mean, by the time we got to the 50s, you know, there was a war in there that kind of changed everything and puts a lot of stuff on hold. But once 1950 came, they decided, okay, we want to document the recovery of wildlife. And so to do that, we're going to create a scoring system that rewards the traits that are associated with the healthiest specimens,
right,
knowing that the habitat that produce the healthiest specimens is the best habitat. So we can say, okay.
So wherever there are Boone and Crockett, older mature right. males, we can say that something right is happening
right.
there in terms of habitat.
And you can't look at the records and say, oh, clearly there's a predation issue. But you can say, well, this county used to produce X number of entries every 10 years. We haven't seen one in 20. What changed? You could look at another county that went the other way. And so you've got two points that you can say, okay, well, something's going well here and not there. And it's kind of a starting point. So it doesn't
right.
answer all the questions, but, you know, with 50...
And that was the original yeah. intent. That was the original intent of the records.
Yep. That was why they decided to put effort into it.
Right. And what you just said right there, we can jump into this, just something that I think every hunter probably deals with at some point in their life. The Boone and Crockett scoring system is so prevalent and has so deeply infiltrated every aspect of anybody that hunts, especially whitetails, talks about the score of a deer. And what they're talking about is the Boone and Crockett score of the deer. I mean, you know, they say that's 140-inch whitetail. That's 130-inch whitetail. And people now are massively quick to dog a net score. But I think it's fascinating. And I bet if we were to poll everybody that's listening to this podcast right now and say, how many of you know why there is such thing as a net score? And it's because what you just said, bilateral symmetry typically means a healthy animal.
Correct.
Lack of symmetry indicates an unhealthy animal. And also, this would have been information that these guys had, you know, a long time ago.
There's definitely some traits that they probably rewarded. Certain categories, caribou for one, maybe aren't. The science doesn't necessarily agree, but you have that long of a system with one particular category.
Right.
With whitetail, it still does. You know, there is some research that shows like split brow tines could be genetically inherited, but the majority of the time when you see those crazy abnormalities, some form of stressor. Maybe it's bugs, maybe it's an injury from a fence or a car. You know, the net score and the gross score, you know, we bring that up. Everybody's like, oh, give him credit for what he grew. Well, the system isn't trying to reward freak traits or these oddities. And that's right. The other thing. We have a typical category, not a perfect category. What does a white-tailed deer look like unpressured in a natural environment where everything is in good numbers? And still to this day, it's a symmetrical, heavy, long-tined rack. You know,
and that's what the system gets credit
for. And that's exactly what is the typical white-tailed deer.
The reason, and again, if you understand that the Boone and Crockett record was originally designed to be a biological record-keeping system that showed us where habitat was good and where it wasn't, where there were problems with conservation, where there wasn't, then you understand that when a deer has this massive lack of symmetry, that the records, just from that philosophical idea, would have to deduct from that. So that's the whole point of it. Yep. And I think if people knew that, they would be not quite as judgy against the system.
Well, you know? And I mean, the gross score, people understand what that is now, and it's useful.
Yeah.
That tells me if I have a deer that grosses 165 and nets 162, you tell me that number, I instantly know, oh man, that's a very typical deer. That's everything is great.
It's a good typical.
You know, whereas you have, oh, this deer grosses 201 and nets 160, you know that there's some craziness going on there, that there's a lot of inches of abnormality or deduction. You know, the broken tines, we hear that a lot. I mean, that's generally a sign of a high population of males. That's an overpopulation.
That's a good point.
So they're breaking tines off.
So you're
that's not a natural thing.
Yeah.
Therefore, it becomes a deduction in the system because it's all about ranking the habitat and the health of the species.
Right.
It was never meant for a hunter to say, you know, I have number 75 whitetail in the book. I'm the 75th best hunter in the country.
Right.
That's not at all what the system was ever
for. I think that would shock most people.
Yeah.
Like, it really would. Like, somebody that would have no context of what these record-keeping clubs do, they would think that's what this whole thing was about. But when you understand that so much of who we are as hunters today came from the Boone and Crockett Club, it's pretty amazing.
And, you know, the Boone and Crockett Club, it was a lot of individual members back then, too. That's an important thing. A lot of these guys, this was their passion. I mean, they're prolific writers. Roosevelt, clearly. Grinnell. Boone and Crockett kind of joined them, but it was those founders of conservation, that basically built what we have today. I mean, Pittman, Robertson, under FDR, all this stuff. Lacey Act, you know, the big wildlife deal. Well, there's two Lacey Acts. The one that we all know, there was a previous one around Yellowstone National Park. I mean, these guys were absolute giants.
Where would, you know, I talk a lot about the North American Model of Wildlife Conservation. Would that have been, I know that would have spun from the ideology of the Boone and Crockett Club, but, I mean, where did that fit in? Where at some point in history did we say, we have a North American Model for Wildlife Conservation in these, I think it's the, is it the five pillars or seven pillars? Yeah.
So that document was not produced until recent times.
Okay.
And that was never a blueprint
for
how to do it. What it was I believe Val Geist and another, you know, prolific biologist sat down and said, what did North America
do
different, and what are the key components to the system we set up? So, you know, the North American model, clearly, the idea of it, the publicly owned wildlife.
Can we hash them out? Do you know them? I mean, I know you do know them, but if you were,
I couldn't list them for you.
I bet we could list a lot of them. I bet Becca could list all of them. No, one of them would be one. Really, let's try. We don't have to get them all, but one of them would be publicly owned wildlife. So, like in Africa, if you own 10,000 acres, all the wildlife on that. It most, I'm generalizing.
I believe the word's held in public trust in the Seven Sisters. Okay.
So, but the idea is that in some places in the world, well, in a lot of the European countries, the wildlife is owned by people. So if you owned 1,000 acres, the animals on that would be yours. Here, Roosevelt and these guys said, hey, wildlife is public. So even if you have deer on private land, it's owned. Those deer are your neighbors, just like they're yours. Mm-hmm. So there's this community value placed on them. So public trust of wildlife.
Yep. Scientific management.
Scientific-based management. So you're not... you're not managing things based upon emotions like we're seeing now in yep. some places that are going totally against everything that has got us to this point, like what we're seeing in British Columbia with mm-hmm. with them banning the grizzly hunt. Totally not based on scientific information. It's based on just emotional, we like bears and don't want to see hunters shoot them.
Yep.
Okay, so that's two. I've got one. Non-frivolous use of wildlife. Isn't that one of them? Isn't that the way it's worded?
Yeah, I don't know if that's the same as commercial.
It's in the same pillar.
But no commercial value, which is very interesting at the time.
Well, that may be a different one. I just remember non-frivolous use, which basically meant that if you shoot something, you eat it.
Right. Right.
Or if you shoot a predator, there's purpose behind it. You know, right. we've got too many mountain lions and not enough deer. We need to kill a mountain lion, you know,
mm-hmm.
As opposed to, hey, let's go kill 30 buffalo today and cut their tongues out.
Right, right.
You know?
Correct.
And that ethic is deeply implanted into every little boy and girl in the country that has a BB gun. You know, if you, don't shoot it unless you're going to, you know, you gotta eat it if you're going to shoot it, you know. There's three. Colby, have you got them up? Oh, we got our man
how
here.
How about how a wildlife doesn't have a value, like a market value?
Yep, the
like
commercialization. Oh, that's okay. What I was. Okay. That was when I was talking. Yeah. About.
Okay, we got him here. Okay, in public trust, wildlife belongs to the people and managed in trust for the people by the government agencies. Number two, prohibition on commerce of dead wildlife. It'll be illegal to sell the meat of any wild animal in North America. So, and that comes from a time when market hunters made a living. Guys in Arkansas made a living being bear hunters, selling the oil, selling the meat. You know, can't do that anymore.
You know that's why a buck is called a buck, right? $1 was the price of a deer.
Right. Yeah. I thought you were going to say, an eel of bear oil was the tanned neck of a deer filled with bear oil. I know I've read some literature back in... from the South, at least. Oh, Colby, can you open that back up? Where they would take the hide of a deer, tan it, and make like a pouch, you know, waterproof pouch. Mm-hmm. And how much bear oil would be an eel? I think it's ELL, maybe ELL. And that was a unit of measurement.
Hmm.
Okay, allocation of wildlife is by law. Laws developed by the people and enforced by government agencies will regulate the proper use of wildlife resources. So that would mean that we submit ourselves to the laws. I came to Montana, and I can only kill one bear, and I got to pay for it, and I got to check it. And today, we took the bear. Oh, spoiler alert. took the bear to Missoula to have it checked in. For opportunity for all. Every citizen has the freedom to hunt and fish. I've got a story. We've got some friends that live in Wales, part of England, and they watch some of our YouTube videos of us hunting. And to them, it's just like bizarre. Now, they like it, but to them, it's just like that we are just like the craziest people on the planet that we would go kill a bear. And this lady told me, she says, Clay, every time I see you shoot a bear, go ahead and do it for me. I couldn't hear you. She says, I think, that's the king's bear. She literally says that her heart stops beating because she thinks that I just killed the king's bear. And I'm like, no, ma'am. Pillar number four of the North American Model of Wildlife Conservation is that opportunity for all. Every citizen has the freedom to hunt.
And we're all kings and queens. It's fantastic. We're so lucky.
Yes, exactly. Now, when I was at the Boone and Crockett class, one of the things that impacted me was it seems so common because we've grown up with this idea that wildlife is in public trust and that we have the right to come and go hunt these animals. But we were coming from Roosevelt and all these guys were coming from a system that said these animals belong to, I mean, literally, like the king. I mean, back way down. That's part of the reason adventurers like to come to North America to hunt. There's a book that is my favorite book of all time. I can't disclose the title because we're going to do a podcast on it. It was this German guy that came to Arkansas and hunted. And he hunted just like all those guys did back in the early 1800s. Pretty indiscriminate killing of stuff. But he came here to hunt and was just like a mountain man for 7 years in Arkansas. Because he came from Europe where he couldn't do that. So he came here because he could. Man, I've got Colby's phone here, and I keep losing it. Okay, we're on number four. Okay, number five is non-frivolous use, which we already talked about. Number six is international resources. Because wildlife and fish freely migrate across boundaries between states and provinces and countries, they are considered an international resource. So basically, we've partnered with Canada and presumably Mexico with some of the migratory animals. And then number seven is managed by science, which we've already talked about. So those are the seven. Those are the seven pillars,
right?
That weren't formed by, you know, these guys, but basically their influence 100 years later produced these things,
right?
So. Pretty incredible.
Yeah, no, and like I said, it was new ideas, and those guys framed it, but it wasn't written down as the North American model until far later, which is important to remember because we're facing different challenges, and some of these things have a different look to them. You know, commercial value of wildlife. Well, back then it was the meat. Now we have a value to shed antlers.
Right.
This is a question that we need to look at and say, you know, are we again putting an unnecessary stress onto a species by giving it an economic value, which clearly it needs to have some economic value so people take ownership in it and want to preserve it or conserve it, whatever. But we have to ask ourselves, you know, are all these exactly what we need to do now? You know, the international... it's an international resource. Well, that's one discussion on the Endangered Species Act and potentially, you know, updating it. We just had caribou that they just trapped the last one in the lower 48 and took it back to Canada.
Hmm.
There's issues there, which were in our time, caribou that used to come into Montana and Idaho are now no longer here because of practices that were happening on both sides of the border. And so that we might need to look at that one a little closer and say, hey, we used to do this. Why are we not dealing with this Selkirk caribou herd the same way that, for example, the Migratory Bird Act that was an early on thing, which is where that came from, you know, the duck stamp, Ding Darling, another club member, the first duck stamp between Canada, the U.S. and Mexico on the migratory birds. And so, like I said, we always caution people to not say that this is the written law. But that structure is what, you know, the basics.
Can you see any other places inside of that? That's an interesting point, that there could be modern challenges that could, I mean, you mentioned two. Are there any others that you can think of?
I mean, those are the two that right now are front and center, you know, questions that we're looking at. And, you know, honestly, I mean, the caribou thing hit me deep. I guess I never thought that I'd be somewhere that would lose a big game species.
Yeah.
And it happened. And we didn't say much. And I don't know why. you know, but the scientific management's another big one that, you know, now the problem is it seems like everybody's got the science that says what they want to say. Mm. And so that isn't necessarily a problem. We still want the best science driving our decisions, but how do we define what the best science is? How do we make sure that we're not managing on emotion purely, which is not a solid way to ensure the future of wildlife?
That is probably from my perspective, the biggest threat to at least predator management, predator hunting, is just this non-scientific based legislation that people can get through in basically referendum type governments.
Right.
Wherever that there is a government set up where you can, for wildlife related issues, just get a bunch of people on a ballot to sign, you know, to say we want to ban this type of hunting, and then it goes into their legislative systems, and like in Arkansas and in a lot of the states, non-referendum states is the way I've heard it described, there's documentation in Arkansas where wildlife related issues are to be totally managed by the state.
Is that a commission or is that a?
It's a commission. And people have problems with it, you know. I mean, people are like, well, the commission's this or the commission's that. And I say, man, I would rather be run by 9 commissioners that are vetted at least in some way to care about wildlife and hunting than to be thrown to the masses who can be swayed by the millions and zillions of dollars put into propaganda against us by some of these big anti-hunting organizations. And that's what they do. Yeah. I mean, that's what the Humane Society of America does. That's what other groups do. They funnel money into places that they think they can win, and they do these big campaigns in places that they think they can sway people who don't have information, or who have no background for it. I mean, it's an easy sell, you know. It's an easy sell someone that's never seen a grizzly bear, never bear hunted, never seen a mountain lion. To say, why would someone want to kill a mountain? I mean, you know,
right.
I'm preaching to the choir, but that's a massive threat. I mean, I think it's the biggest threat that we have.
And the one thing that we always talk about with fair chase and ethics and hunting, and, you know, we address certain things that a lot of times, oh, you know, why is Boone and Crockett splitting hunters? Why are you dividing hunters? Well, let's think about this in a numbers game. Hunters are what, 6% of the country? If we're doing something that the rest of the country doesn't approve of, it doesn't matter if every one of us agrees with it. We're not going to continue because we do not have the majority. We'll never have the majority. It's that 70-something percent of the country that is not a hunter but approves of hunting that we have to make sure everything we do meets their seal of approval so we can continue on and continue funding the wildlife we have to continue to keep it on the landscape as we see today. I mean, the best numbers ever. We are living in the good old days of whitetail, of black bear, of all these species. This is the most there's ever been. And it's not across the board. I mean, clearly bison obviously numbered far more. But if we get so hung up on, well, I want to do it this way and this should be fine, and you don't look at the bigger picture, that's far more damaging than having a civil discussion amongst hunters on a particular tactic on how that'll be viewed by the non-hunting but approving public.
What you know, I've noticed the last several years Boone and Crockett's their social media approach and some of the things they're doing, and I mean, it seems to be a pretty big emphasis on let me ask you, what would you say Boone and Crockett's emphasis has been to the hunting community, if I could ask that? And I don't know if you can sum that up in a short, and I'm kind of alluding to what you just said, that
I mean, we've really tried to take the Hunt Fair Chase campaign. This was something we did earlier.
Is that designed more as much for? Are we marketing as much to non-hunters about fair chase as we are to hunters?
We'd love to, but let's be honest, we're good at talking to ourselves. And before we can take this to the general public, we as the hunting community have to be all under the same roof.
Yeah.
And so before we can take this forth and say, here's what we are as hunters, here's what we believe in, here's why what we're doing is the best path forward for wildlife. We need to have all the hunters say, like, hey, this is what we're doing, this is why it matters. Not, you know, not a, you know, well, the state law says I can do this, so therefore I can, and if you don't like it, too dang bad. That's not going to get us anywhere. So yeah. We're trying to get hunters to understand what the bigger picture is, why it's important to be careful about what you post on social media. You know, not, I mean, respect the animal. I'm not a big fan of the, you know, there's people that say never put a kill shot on social media. Well, I don't agree. I mean, that the if a well-taken trophy photo or a kill photo sums up, could be 20 days, my moose hunt, 20 days in one picture, sitting there on your knees, you're exhausted, you're looking at a moose, you're respecting it, you're in awe of its size. That one photo has power.
Yeah.
But that's a well-taken photo. That's not a deer hanging upside down on a chain hoist over a gut bucket.
Yeah.
You know, so think about this stuff. And that's what we're trying to do, is get hunters together, you know, and that's what you're seeing on social media is, hey, let's think about what we're doing. We're hunters aren't poachers. Poachers are more the... Poachers are more of an enemy.
I see a lot of that on Boone and Crockett's social media feed, is trying to make a clear distinction that poaching is not hunting. And I mean, to hunters, that's a pretty clear thing.
Right.
But to people that don't know anything about hunting, they very well may have an idea that hunters are just a bunch of outlaws.
Right.
You know? But no, that's super interesting stuff.
Becca, you've been quiet over there.
No, I love this conversation. I think it's great because so Boone and Crockett is a very small office, and it's a group of incredibly hardworking people that pretty much work behind the scenes. They're not getting, you know, their message isn't getting told as well as it maybe should be. All the work they're doing for conservation, and I think it's great. This is good stuff to talk about. I'm glad it's getting out there.
Yeah. Well, I just know for real when I came to Missoula for the measuring class. I mean, like, I came out of it. We actually brought our whole family up. We drove up from Arkansas, 2014. I think it was 2014. Drove up from Arkansas. We're here for 3 days. And when I left, I told my wife, I said, this is going to change my life. And not that being a scorer really changed my life. I mean, I enjoy scoring big game. I don't really score that much. I'm not in a hotbed of big racks, but you know, I probably score 5 to 7 animals a year.
Yep.
And half of them don't make the book, you know, but the association with the club really, it helped me because it gave me the narrative. It gave me insight to things that I was already doing that I wouldn't have known why. I mean, you know, like my dad, you know, I mean, a lot of the things he instilled in me just as a young hunter about taking an ethical shot. I mean, my dad was a bow hunter. I always say he was bow hunting before it was cool back in the 1970s in Arkansas. He is, like, massively concerned with ethical shots long before people were – that was, like, mainstream, you know, like – and you know, a lot of that I think comes from these ethics put into just respect of wildlife. This is a treasure that we have access to. This is a shared resource. I mean, a lot of these ideas, but so I'm just saying the class was influential. How many classes a year do y'all do?
We usually do 2 to 3.
Yeah.
You know, some years we have more interest, you know, than others from different agencies. So we'll travel a little bit, but we generally do 2 classes a year in Missoula, and we're also working very closely with Pope and Young now. And okay. So both these organizations use the same scoring system, and so we're working very hard with them to have a unified front. You know, yeah. All the majors train the same. And again, it's Pope and Young's purpose for records is to promote bow hunting, and originally it was set up to prove that archery was a viable method for harvest.
Right.
And so the founder of Pope and Young, Glenn St. Charles, was a member of Boone and Crockett, which our original rule said you had to have taken with a rifle 3 big game animals. Uh-huh. Well, Glenn St. Charles was the first club member that was accepted in that took those 3 animals with a bow.
Okay.
And so he asked the club, can we use the system to promote this with our record system, but it's the same scoring. The rules are you know, roughly the same. And so between the two that we do and Pope and Young usually does two, we're doing about four now a year.
And so for those who wouldn't be familiar at all with the scoring organizations, you guys train measures, and these measures just go back to where they live. Like, I'm in Northwest Arkansas, and people in my region can contact me to score animals for them.
Yep.
I mean, that's basically it. So you got people all over the country, and I think it's pretty interesting. I've found that there's a lot of guys that being a Boone and Crockett measure is like a big part of like who they are. It's a big part of their identity. They love it. I mean, they and as I say that, I'm not saying that I don't love it, but I'm not like traveling around to score animals. There's guys that there's a guy that comes to the Arkansas. There are people that love, and they will drive. I mean, they that's just what they do.
Yeah, and they're passionate conservationists.
Yeah, yeah. I'd like to go back to what you said about, yo, I don't score much a year. I don't. That doesn't matter if you score one thing or 500 things. I think the message, that unified message of conservation that BNC and Pope and Young Measures are sending out there is what's important. And
that's really what's because the director of records is sitting right in front of me, everybody that I score an animal for gets an earful from me about everything we're talking about. I'm serious. I really do. I'm like, hey, did you know why we're doing this? Do you know why that we – and people just eat it up. Well, they really do.
And that's the success of Boone and Crockett. Our staff in Missoula is 13. We have 1,400 measures. The reason that people know what fair chase is, the reason that people, you know, want to get stuff scored and understand what is our measures. And we can't, you know, we can't thank you guys enough for everything that you do. And our success is purely off of the measures and the face they put forward.
Yeah.
And so it's in, I mean, the measures take great pride in it, but they are, I mean, again, they are the Boone and Crockett Records program. It's not me sitting in Missoula, you know, answering a question on which tine is going to be the beam tip or which is the, you know, that it's the measures driving that message home, which is why we have the following and the name recognition we do.
Yeah. And you know, the record keeping system, every time I score an animal, usually for the people I'm scoring for, it's a once in a lifetime thing. I got a guy drive last week, had me score a bear, and he drove 3 hours one way, came to my office, we scored the bear, he drove home. And for him, it was like, this was like a day. I mean, I could tell when he got to my office, like, and I have to remind myself, to me, it was just like, yeah, I'll score the bear, come to my office at such and such a time. But man, when he came, I mean, it was like something I don't think he'll ever forget. I mean, he was on pins and needles. And, you know, I was scoring a bear, so it like, didn't take very long, you know. But I was kind of stretching it out, you know, kind of talking with him and getting the story. And
don't say stretching it out. No, you're not stretching about
that. You know what I mean. Stretching
revoked.
Stretching. I'm out. What, how can we say it? We elongated the time that it took.
Okay.
I just, you know, took my time, you know. Anyway, but it was a big deal to him. And I started that story. I can't remember exactly where I was going with it, but it's a really unique place and way to meet people, and it's a lot of fun. A lot of fun being a measure. I enjoy it. But we've got a, before we get off of the records though, Justin, we've got a story that we got to get Becca to tell. But before we do, can you is there anything else you'd like to say about Boone and Crockett? Just for the people out here, you're a young man, Justin. You're like in your mid-30s, am I right?
Yep.
So, I mean, Justin's got an incredible job. He told earlier how he kind of the short version of how he ended up here. But, I mean, you've got a really incredible job. You were just down in Springfield.
Missouri, yep. We've got our 30th Big Game Awards. We were down at Bass Pro Shop setting up a display. It's open to the public.
Yeah.
It's at the end of every 3-year period. We require the top five in every category to be sent in for panel verification. This is to make sure they were scored correctly. And all those heads were panel judged 2 weeks ago. I kind of lost track of time. I was down there for a while. But the judges come in. It's two teams of two that they verify the scoring. And then they go up on display for 3 months. And so literally it is the greatest collection of modern trophies taken in the time of, you know, of this, plenty, the good old days. You walk in there and you look at the elk display. In the last 3 years, there's the bulls that were the top 3 years ago would not have even been invited this time.
Wow.
Because the elk had such an amazing 3 years with the water available. You know, Montana had a great year a couple years ago. There was a 430-inch typical kill, the 436, I believe, non-typical.
Wow.
And both those bulls are there. There's a bull from the San Carlos. There's some amazing Roosevelts from British Columbia. You have the largest sheep ever recorded. It was a picked-up head from Montana, hour and a half north of here on Wild Horse Island. Yeah. A 216-inch bighorn is on display. Below it's a 208, a 205. I mean, these numbers are unheard of.
And what was the biggest bear, Justin? Do you remember? Black bear?
22s. 22.
Where did it come from? Do you remember?
There's a Pennsylvania bear there. I don't remember. I did not set up that part of the display. Okay. I was pulled into the sheep, which I was not upset about. But there's the largest brown bear ever taken with a bow is on display there.
Ah, yeah, yeah.
That's a life-size mount.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's pretty impressive.
So this is at Bass Pro Shops in Springfield, Missouri, for the next 3 months until
the banquet happens August 1 through 3.
Okay.
If folks are interested in that, you can biggameawards.com.
I'm going to do my darndest to be there.
Yeah.
With at least some of my family.
Well, again, our OMs are the backbone of the program, and this is our one opportunity to try to get them there and do stuff for them.
So. I wear my Boone and Crockett belt buckle like all the time. I'm serious. People at my church, when they see me wear the belt buckle, they're like, Clay's got the buckle on. And they all know what it's for. And all the guys, I'm serious, they come up to me and they say, Clay, I wish I could wear a belt buckle that meant something like your belt buckle.
Yep.
I'm serious. Like 2 weeks ago, my buddy came up and he was like, you know what's cool that you've got that belt buckle? Because, you know, it's a Boone and Crockett belt buckle. You're a Boone and Crockett measure.
Anybody can buy a buckle.
Yeah. That's what he was saying. Because I said, you should get a buckle. And he was like, nope. I hadn't rode a bronc or hadn't got bucked off a bull or hadn't become an official measurer.
Conservation's a rodeo, man.
Colby, that's the title of this podcast. Conservation's a rodeo.
I want to bring up one thing, too, that I'm an official measurer, too. I bugged Justin so much.
I didn't know that, Becca.
Oh, I bugged him, finally got me in a class.
That's awesome.
But I think it's so important that everyone knows that no matter if you have a 160-inch whitetail or, you know, world record polar bear, that is a really important data point. And to see it as a data point, and you correct me if I'm wrong, Justin, I know you will, but you can even enter stuff anonymously into the
potentially.
Okay. But, I mean, it's not all about – I mean, yes, it's very cool to have the hunter's name in the book, but it's not all – that's not what it's all about. It's really important to have those data points. I mean, that is what wildlife managers use to gauge the health of our wildlife populations.
I mean, on her point, she's exactly correct. Iowa is a great example. The deer there are phenomenal. Iowa is the land of giants. People won't even put in 165, 170-inch deer if they have a 175 because they just think it's about their biggest deer getting
just
in there.
Just a ranking, yeah.
But when I'm looking at Iowa, you know, it is a true success story of what happens when you allow deer to get age. And so when it's got so good and that bottom part of that data set drops out, it's not as strong of a case. So when we are talking to an anti-hunter or trying to make the case to somebody of how hunting and you know, the funding that it brings in and all the good it does for wildlife and the reason that there is deer in everybody's yard and, you know, we can spot a black bear off of our deck. I mean, that is because of hunting, and I need that data
right
at my fingertips to show people,
right,
this is what we've done. Here's an example. Where are you from? Oh, you're from Iowa? Let me show you what the deer there used to be and what they are now because of this work. So everything, every right. single one is very important to us. And like I said, a 160 from a new county carries just as much, if not more weight than a 220 typical.
Right. That, and see, that that's good, really good information. And I think that people ought to put – see, there's a lot of people that have a negative stigma of their records, and they're just like, ah, I'm not worried about records. I don't enter stuff. I mean, I hear that a lot.
Oh, yeah.
And I think people owe it to the history of what's happened over the last 100 years – to put a record book animal in the record book. I mean, just out of principle. It doesn't matter if you like the Boone and Crockett Club or not.
Yep.
You should put it in. That and obviously I'm kind of exaggerating to make a point, because nobody just doesn't like some. Point being, I mean, I think if you've got an animal, it should be entered in.
Well, and you know, we talked about the opportunity for all publicly held. You were fortunate enough to take this deer, but it was everybody before you that put in the work, that made sure that the land wasn't completely stripped, that the wildlife was even there and was able to grow. And so your name next to it, yeah, that's admirable to say, I don't care if my name's in a book, but you know, that county and that date, there's so much that goes into that everybody that got that there deserves to be recognized. And by you not putting that into the data set, you're kind of disregarding their contribution to what gave you the opportunity right. to experience that today.
Yeah.
So.
That's awesome. The I keep forgetting what we're calling it, the banquet. Is it the banquet?
30th Big Game Awards.
30th Big Game Awards in early August.
Yep.
So people, if they came there, they would be able to see all the heads.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also an actual banquet and meal if you have a ticket, and there's speakers. Who's speaking this year?
The Saturday night banquet is Craig Boddington.
Oh, okay.
Is emceeing that. Friday night we started this 4 awards programs ago. Any youth hunter 16 or younger that takes a qualifying trophy is asked to come, and it's displayed.
Oh, yeah.
And they're called up, and it's not a, you know, we don't score them. I mean, the scores are on there, but we do our best to say, you know, it's not about the biggest. This is about a young hunter having this opportunity, getting this, and trying to show them this whole conservation mission. But that's Friday night.
Which has been like the best event.
Yeah.
It has been.
CJ Buck Knives, third or fourth generation, is the MC that evening. Melissa Bachman, she's the keynote that night.
Mm.
And folks are welcome. And, you know, we encourage as many people as can come and show those youth your appreciation, you know, and how amazing this accomplishment is. And so we want to have just as many, if not more, people in the seats Friday night as Saturday night, which are the top heads.
Yeah.
Both events are amazing. But, yeah, biggameawards.com. If you're anywhere near Springfield, it's literally the best of the best and the best time for wildlife.
Yeah.
Bigger and more than ever. I mean, that's what we're kind of saying about this awards.
Incredible.
Because every year it just gets better and better. The trophies, the top-end specimens, trophies that are entered are higher quality, they're healthier, there's better habitat, and this is in the face of an expanding population.
Yeah.
You know, it's just amazing, everything about it.
Cool. Very cool. Well, I'm going to do the best I can do to get there, so that'll be fun.
Well, didn't Becca tell you that was the stipulation for staying at the house and getting food, is you had to come to the awards?
Okay. I'll tell that to my family.
It might get another really cool buckle. I don't know. It just might
be. Ooh, I didn't even want to ask.
Well, you know, as an official major, there's some other things coming, some unique items.
Yes.
As a thank you to you guys for all you do for the club.
That would be awesome. Whatever that would be. Okay. Switching gears just a little bit. You guys, we were just having dinner and you guys were telling me about your caribou hunt in Alaska, drop camp caribou hunt. We don't have to go into the whole, I know you could talk for hours, but you guys both took incredible caribou. Was it last August?
Yep.
Yeah. So Becca, the reason Becca's on this podcast is Becca is a very serious, very good hunter. I mean, for real. And
I'm very lucky to have a pack mule in Justin as well.
Yes. We did learn that the only reason she married Justin is because he can carry big chunks of meat at one time.
That was half of it. The other half was she thought switching her last name to mine might give her better draw odds.
Because you're good at getting draws.
Because I kept drawing Justin. Tags. So she's like, well, if I switch my name, maybe I'll pull a tag.
Yeah.
Still waiting on that one, but that's okay. You have a lot of other good
points. So, Becca, tell us, give me like a 5-minute version or longer of your caribou hunt last fall.
I honestly don't have enough adjectives to describe how awesome that hunt was. So we had planned this, you know, it took probably a year to plan, but we just did a fly out of a drop camp out of Bettles and just with a couple other buddies, and it was just fantastic. We just brought our own gear and just tried to do it as, you know, on our own as we could and got dropped on this fantastic little lake and just started seeing caribou right away. And I had spotted, so Alaska, you can't hunt the day you fly in, right? And so we got our camp set up, whatever, have had dinner, just having a fantastic time on the tundra. And I spotted a real giant bull on one of the surrounding mountains. And like, wow, that's a beautiful bull, but he's not going to be there tomorrow morning when our tags are legal.
Because it's the caribou migration.
Yes, and we're kind of hitting the tail end
of the migration.
Yeah, but I mean, those caribou, just for the most part, it seems like they just don't stand still. You know, they're just you see one, and he's not going to be there, he or she is not going to be there in another hour. And so I spent until the last minute of daylight, I spent with binoculars on that.
How far was he away?
Oh, he's probably a mile away.
Really?
Yeah, it was pretty good distance.
And the tundra, that's a pretty big chunk of ground.
The tundra will kick your butt every day of the week. It's incredible. You can't describe what the tundra's like walking on. It's ankle.
Is it kind of like walking up a Montana slope about 70 degrees?
Yeah.
Just in a different way?
Yeah.
It's a different set of muscles.
Horizontal Stairmaster. Yeah, it's just constantly trying to break your ankles, and you're constantly falling in wet holes, and it's difficult, very difficult terrain. And you've got to cover a lot of country to get these caribou. But
what she didn't say is the other three of us, we knew we could start hunting first thing in the morning, and we'd all gone to bed.
All these suckers were in bed snoring.
And she's like, nope, I'm going to keep glassing.
She's watching. And what was he doing? He was just kind of hanging out?
He was feeding. Yeah, he was up on this. He was up pretty high on this mountain. He was just kind of feeding around, just kind of staying. He was kind of staying in the same area. He was all by himself. And I had told the guys before the trip, like, we were kind of talking about, like, hey, what kind of caribou are you guys looking? What are you looking for in a caribou? And I was like, I'm looking for a double shovel. And Justin was like, oh, you're not going to get one then. Because, you know, it's not a common
thing. I wasn't quite that blunt about it. I think I said, well, that's kind of the...
Really? So double shovel is...
Well,
not normal enough that you even thought you'd see one.
Well, so, I mean, the scoring system, we were talking about rewarding that. There's no deduction on a single shovel because
it's
such
pretty normal.
A common thing for them to have a single underdeveloped shovel on one side. And you know, my joke was, what type of caribou are you looking for? Well, a caribou.
Caribou.
We'd never been there. It was like, I'd love to take a caribou, you know. And she's like, I'm really wanting a double shovel. And you don't want your wife to be let down. And I had to explain to her, like, well, we'll try, but, you know, don't hold your breath. And
tell us what a double shovel is.
So caribou have these fantastic antlers that they have the first kind of, I guess you call it a G1 probably, comes kind of throughout. It's a big flat bladed structure. If it's an actual shovel, sometimes they'll just be a single point as well.
Okay.
But so a double shovel has these two big blades that come out like their G1, these two big blades, and they use those for like scraping around in the tundra. And then
using those for feeding.
Yeah, as actual feeding purpose, I believe. Right? I don't know. I probably shouldn't have said that. And then their G1 is called the Bez or the Bay, and those are like kind of more big curving.
The second time is a Bez, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, like a...
Hey, I'm not even going to open my mouth about scoring caribou.
And they're more of a big curving kind of palmated situation that's coming out that kind of curves around the shovels. Yeah, and they just... Anyway, double shovel was just...
Of all the big game animals that we score, it's the most bizarre set of antlers that probably were ever created. I mean, they really are.
Yeah,
it's such irregularity. I mean, like, caribou, like, you know, a 10-point 140-inch whitetail rack is kind of standard. But, I mean, like, there would be like a stereotypical caribou rack, but I mean, even there's just so much.
Yeah, there's so much uniqueness to them. Every incredible. One of them,
yeah,
you know, looks completely different. And she just pretty much found the best one on the tundra the first
I
night.
Okay, anyway, so okay. I look so up on this hill and there's this beautiful double shovel bull with a big old white man just. You know, but I
and so you watched him until dark,
until I had no more light left, and I was like, said I waved at him and said, well, it was nice seeing you.
Did you literally wave at him?
I literally did.
That is awesome. Because I can see you doing that.
Yep, sayonara, sucker.
You know, yeah. I find that I salute things. like if I'm like I'll be by myself and like I'll be like
for sure he deserved a salute too. He was beautiful sitting up there. Yeah. But then, so next morning, I get, you know, of course, we're all fired up, right? So I'm up for first thing, you know, and of course, it didn't really get all that dark. But anyway, I'm up, I don't know, and it's still light.
Now,
so
is there regulated shooting time during that time in Alaska?
3 a.m., I think, is what the requirement is.
Okay.
There's no shooting hours, but you can't use artificial light or anything. Yeah. And it never really got dark, so you could see just not great. I mean, you know.
So technically, you could have... You could shoot an animal any time during a 24-hour period? Is that what you're saying?
Alaska regulations leave it up to you.
But your time period for the float plane was 3.
You cannot fly.
Yeah.
Unless you're on a commercially scheduled flight, you cannot hunt until 3 a.m. the following day.
Got it. Understood.
But beyond that, it's kind of up to hunter's choice, kind of. Like, if you think that you can see that animal safely, okay, you can shoot at it.
That's why I love Alaska.
Many reasons to love Alaska. But so I get up in the morning, and I honestly didn't even look up on the hill. I was like, he's gone. I was focused on coffee. I'm going to get some coffee and breakfast going. So I went and our little tarp and, you know, got breakfast cranking. And then after things were kind of settled down there, I got out the binos, and this thing's coming down towards camp. He's hiking closer to camp. I just couldn't believe it. Like, I couldn't believe it.
And so the rule was whoever saw the caribou was able to claim it.
Well, I think that was kind of what we're going for. Yeah, I think it was, you know.
So there's four of you in camp.
You shot it kind of thing. Yeah. Yeah, and then it kind of scared. So we woke up to frost. We woke up to a really cold morning. We had all kind of been kind of cold throughout the night. It was a little bit colder than we were anticipating. So we were all kind of huddling around coffee cups and having a breakfast burrito, kind of thinking, I don't know if we quite dressed right for this.
We may not have brought enough clothes.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
What was the temperature?
18 or 19. Yeah. I mean, it was yeah. Everything was frozen.
Like, it's cold.
Good and frozen. And we all had everything that we'd brought on, expecting a little more mild temperatures.
Oh, wow.
And there was a look of panic in all of our eyes.
A
like, oh, 7 days of this? We didn't. And it's the tundra. There's no trees. There's no firewood. Yeah. Like, you're kind of stuck with what you have and what you're prepared for.
Yeah.
So,
we kind of were sitting around having our breakfast, and it became apparent that this caribou was going to just try to run us over in camp. And Justin and I decided we'd head towards that caribou, and then our buddies, they'd head the other way on the lake and, you know, see what was going on the other side of the lake. And, yeah, we took off after this, and Justin gave me honors on it. And, the caribou kind of, because he was walked right towards our lake, and he kind of walked into the Valley of Doom. There was no way he was getting out of there without a boom. And, so Justin kind of went around one side, and I was able to keep getting ridges on him, and got right up in his grill. He came over this last ridge at, you know, about 60 yards, and I was so excited. His head came over the ridge and his neck, and I didn't even wait. I just put one right in his neck. I was just too excited. And he just dropped right there, and it was fantastic.
Wow.
And, yeah, Justin had covered on the back end. If he would have thought about going a different direction,
he was not going to get away. But
yeah, it was just too exciting. And then to have some camp meat already, it was just like to be able to have caribou tenderloin sitting on that lake in the tundra was just like, I don't know, like the best thing ever, pretty much. Just,
wow. So he was velvet, full velvet?
Full velvet, yeah. But yeah.
Are you going to get him mounted in full velvet?
Yeah, so since we killed him on the first day, it was kind of like, yeah, this, you know, we're probably not going to be able to preserve the velvet.
Okay.
So I did end up stripping the velvet in camp, and it came off pretty easy. Like, it was apparent that he was probably going to be stripping soon. And I stripped it all off, and then I'm actually getting the reproduction velvet put on it. And it's actually, the mount will be done soon. And
That'll look incredible. So how tall, like if we had those horns in here right now, how tall would they be?
I don't know. Are they
4 feet tall?
Yeah, probably.
Three and a half tall. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, we got back and, you know, So for Boone and Crockett scoring, if you split the skull, if you saw the skull all the way through, it can't be officially measured. And so we got it back. And I've when I was younger, was hunting with a buddy, and he shot a deer poorly. And the very first thing he did was pull out a tape measure. And it really has bothered me to this day. Like, no, that's not what it's about, as a tape measure. So it was even hard for me to do it, but I'm like, we're going to score it to make sure this isn't, you know.
Oh, before you cut the
skull. Before we split the skull, if this is Boone and Crockett or not.
Oh.
But it was a 390 class caribou with the velvet, just missed the book.
Wow.
But it just an absolute giant. I mean, no, it didn't quite make it, but there's nobody that doesn't shoot that bull first day.
Oh, wow.
You know, even if you're killed numerous caribou. And again, I mean, it's not about a number. It'd be cool if it went. It didn't. But, I mean, just beautiful, beautiful bull.
Yeah.
Wow.
Just bull of my dreams. I couldn't believe it. Yeah.
So he's going to go right here.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so when did you kill the little bull you killed, Justin?
So that was like day three, and after she
I'm joking,
she
people.
Said,
I've seen these pictures.
It's a nice...
Justin killed a big bull.
Justin killed a bull that I was kind of expecting. It's a nice caribou, a 300-inch, you know, just kind of average bull.
Right,
bigger than what we saw, but that's what I was kind of thinking. We'd never done it on our own, just get dropped off.
Yeah.
Like, okay, we may have a little bit of knowledge of what a big caribou looks like, but beyond that, like, we don't know how to hunt these things. And so it was day three, and we'd let a lot of bulls go on day two.
Mm.
And it was one of those things that I was thinking to myself, if I wait and try to outdo my wife, I'm going to go home with tag soup.
Yeah.
And so this bull happened to be coming towards camp, and it was fairly entertaining. We'd come back to camp for lunch. I don't remember why we were there, but we were all sitting around having a sandwich. And I decided to just wander out from the tent to a high point in glass, and this herd of like 10 caribou is just coming at a clip right over towards camp. So I turned to run back, and like Becca said, the tundra's full of holes and whatnot, and made it three or four steps, and then the top half got going faster than the bottom half, and I went down in a heap and came up, you know, and they couldn't figure out what was happening.
So they're watching you
camp. Yeah, they can't, like, am I running?
Becca says that when Justin runs, it's scary.
I was concerned. Yes, it's always concerning because he's a big guy and he can run really fast, and it is always like, I don't know what I need to do. Do I need to run to?
What you should do when you see Justin Spring running is get him a rifle.
Yes, and that's what I did. And I grabbed his backpack and we went.
But I mean, her bull we stalked from camp. This one ended up coming pretty darn close, and a couple hundred yards, maybe 200-300 yards, where he was set up and got a shot at him. Basically, all four caribou. We hunted and hiked around and did all that, but all four of them ended up. You know, you could see from where we were camped where all four of these bulls ended up.
That just sounds like a dream hunt.
Oh, it was. You couldn't script a better hunt.
Now, how common would you say it would be for somebody to go up there and kind of do the same type thing you did for them to find that kind of success? I mean, maybe not a near Boone and Crockett caribou, but just like, and I'm asking this for like personal reasons.
I would say if
you have a good outfitter, they're going to put you where the caribou are.
So this was a drop.
It was a flying service.
So it wasn't an outfitted hunt.
No,
they're a transporter. So there are services. A lot of people, I wouldn't have known this 6-7 years ago, that there are services in Alaska that you pay a small sum.
Comparatively small sum.
To an outfitted hunt. Yeah.
Right.
I mean, basically, you're paying for their services to take you into, you know, you can do it with moose, you can do it with caribou. So that's what you did. You used a transport service. They just dropped you off and said, hey, we'll be back in 7 days.
There's very specific rules. I mean, they can't help you load your meat. They can't give you any direction. I mean, they're purely there for safety. You can call them. We were scheduled for 7 days. You know, the North Slope, I mean, weather's an issue. The day that we got the guy killed the fourth bull, we went and helped him pack, and Beck and I got back to camp, and there was planes flying. And so we called the outfitter or the transporter and said, hey, you know, we're killed out. We see a lot of your planes flying. Can you, do you have an empty that you could take some meat back? They have a meat cooler. And I was, you know, the meat was dry and we took very good care of it, but you're still worried. You don't go all the way up there and you don't want to waste the caribou. So I was like, hey, can we get our meat out? Maybe we'll stay and fish or whatever. And they happened to have an otter, which is De Havilland's biggest float plane that you can basically drive a truck onto and fly it out.
And like, theirs happens to have a 1,000 horsepower upgrade, which is the most awesome plane ever.
Hmm.
Yeah, so that's another one of Becca's things. She actually was almost ready to solo to become a float plane pilot, too, when she was younger. Yeah. Yeah, my wife's kind of an all-star. So, anyway. But they said, yeah, and so within 3 hours of that Caribou getting back to camp, we had everything broke down, thrown on the plane, and in 5 days, we're flown back to Bettles. So, it was...
That's an incredible hump.
If you just go up there and think that they're just going to wander up to you, you're going to be disappointed.
Right.
If you're in shape, if you're willing to hunt, you know, I mean, yeah, we got very lucky and got them very close to camp.
Right.
But the other guys we were with, they'd put on 20 miles on that tundra.
Really?
You know, and...
So you can't see, so it's rolling hills, so like, you move around and you can see new country. I mean, sometimes when I think of tundra, I think of being down in some big valley where...
Well, we were in a valley, and we were one side of us was the edge of an area that we couldn't hunt. It's only open for locals. And then we had a mountain range in front of us and behind us. And these caribou, when they migrate, it's not straight line. I mean, they're going this way. They're going that way. They're going up the mountain. They're coming down the mountain. They're going back up the mountain.
So you got to go out and look for them.
Right. And you know, we could see a lot of country, and we ended up in a good spot. But you're not going to be, you know, middle-aged and out of shape and be able to go up there and hunt hard for 7 days and do what you have to do to kill a caribou. That being said, you can get lucky and, you know, just have a trip of a lifetime like we did. I mean, saw 2 wolverines, a muskox, 7 grizzly bears. I mean, it was amazing, amazing.
Mm. How big is the caribou? 400 pounds? 500 pounds?
Tiny.
Smaller?
Smaller.
Really?
Big mule deer.
No way.
Yep.
Really?
Yeah, they are not a big animal.
Like 250, 300 pounds?
They're very fluffy. Their hide is very thick.
Bug, just big old stink bug on my neck.
It scared me. I wasn't sure if I should get him a rifle.
Exactly.
Justin just started swatting profusely in the air and paused after a question. Beck and I both didn't know what to do.
No,
I would have thought a caribou would have weighed 400 or 500 pounds.
They were not large.
So that's actually advantageous for hauling out of the
We would,
it's not like killing a moose.
The third one we got, and the second biggest bull between mine and Becca's, he'd shot across the river, and they had to do a river crossing, which was super sketchy, you know, like very top of the hip waders. They were soaking wet. They'd been hiking all day. So we met them, and, you know, they were obviously tired, and so I just started putting the meat in my pack. I had the majority of that caribou in, and it was not that much, you know, bone. I mean, it wasn't boned out. You have to leave the meat on the bone, but I think I had 3/4 in there and definitely could have taken more. It wasn't like an elk or anything where, you know, 1/4 is going to be a full load.
Yeah. Well, that's a great story that shows what you guys love to do. I mean, we're sitting here and we've got moose and bear and, mountain goats, and I mean, you guys are hunters, so that's pretty cool that you guys as a couple went up there and did that. Not very few couples that I know would have done that, and both people enjoyed it.
I don't know, it's pretty similar to you and Misty just coming up here. Like, you've been up here a couple times now. We just came and jumped in both feet first and just went for it. And I'm really impressed with that. You know, that was really like just went for it with very little information. Just went for
it.
And and you worked hard and panned out. I mean,
yeah, what she's referring to is in 20. Did we decide it was 15?
Yes.
In 2015, my wife Misty, we drove up all the way from Arkansas, and on Justin and Becca's recommendation, went back into an area and hunted for. I think we only hunted for 5 days, but we left the truck. We didn't come back for 5 days, and to this day, Misty talks about that. And now Misty is not a big hunter. I mean, she loves to go with me. She loves to support me. She loves eating wild game. But, you know, she's not like, let's go hunting. But she wanted to come to Montana on this hunt. But there were just too many. She runs a school, and there was just so much going on. And she's getting her PhD, too. So she just couldn't swing it. So I had to bring Colby.
Yeah.
Colby's a great guy and all, but he's no Misty Newcomb.
Right, right.
Colby. Colby doesn't have his microphone. He can't defend himself. If I could, you wait till the podcast when we talk about Colby. This guy, he's not fast, but he's tough as a brick. Mm-hmm. He really is. He wasn't prepared for this hunt at all. But anyway, Misty and I came up here and did this a couple years ago, and so it was a lot of fun. And she would like to come back. She wants to come back. So, and when I tell her about the hospitality, I already have. If you talk to Misty right now, Becca, she would say every time I talk to her, I tell her what you fed us and what we. And we've been in the backcountry for, I think, four. We stayed here 2 nights, 4 of 6. But we were kind of coming and going to different areas, doing a few different things. But anyway, super, super appreciate the hospitality for sure.
It's fantastic having you here. And, I hope you and Misty come back.
Yeah.
So Becca, you're on a bear hunting podcast.
Yeah.
And there's a story that you have about a bear that your husband loves to tell because it just shows how awesome you are.
An angry sow in Middle Oregon.
Tell us the story. We can end on this. We got to hear the full story of this, though.
Oh, boy. So, Justin is from the Oregon coast. When we got out of college, we met in college in Wisconsin. We went to find jobs on the Oregon coast because it seemed like a good idea. And he already had a job, and I got a job with a...
We both have degrees in wildlife, biology, natural resources. She also has geoscience. So natural resource jobs is what we were looking for. So
yeah, and I got a job with a private consulting firm that was doing surveys for marbled murrelets. And these are, if for people who don't know, they're these kind of, I guess, locally endangered seabirds that fly inland for some crazy reason to lay a single egg on an old growth tree on the coastal ranges of Oregon. Well, actually, all up and down the coast. But they're locally endangered. I don't know, because their population is kind of suffering a little bit. But it's really in the very southern edge of their range is why they're suffering. But anyway, these marbled murrelets require a very unique survey technique. You need to hike into these stands of old growth timber in the dark, and then these birds fly in the dark, and you hear them, they make this specific noise. They go, kier, 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 kier. And they have these circling patterns because they can't really land because they're a seabird. And so they're doing these circles to try to land on this tree that they're like a flying potato. Mm. Picture a flying potato. They struggle with life. And so these birds,
somehow they've managed to live for.
They're doing fantastic up in Alaska, where they have much better habitat for what they do.
Oh, okay.
To try to quantify what their population status is, you have people that are hiking into these timber stands in the middle of night or in the early morning hours and sitting there for 2 hours and waiting for these birds to see if they show up or not and like quantify their behavior. So I had a stand or a station that was particularly nasty. It was down way down in this draw, about 2 miles from the truck. So I had to get in there pretty early. It was pitch black. I got my headlamp on. I got a little flashlight, and I had trail. You flag in a trail, a few days before, reflective tape.
Yep.
So that you know how you're going to get in there. And so my lovely husband had just purchased me a Glock that he told me I should carry. But me being from northern Minnesota and having dealt with bears my whole life in Canada and stuff, I thought I was all tough and I don't need no stupid pistol. I'm fine, right? I can handle any bear that comes along. So I leave that in the truck because that was a good idea and hike down to my station. It's pitch black, right? So I get to my station. It's a pretty bad station. It's very brushy. It's actually not – it was poor habitat. Wasn't anticipating seeing any murrelets or hearing anything. So I get everything set up. You take weather, you take temperature, you kind of take some readings for the day. And so I was kind of getting all my stuff set up. And it was a very calm morning. There was no wind. It was a very kind of oppressive morning. And I hear some soft pads. It was immediately I could tell by the sound. It wasn't an elk, wasn't a deer. Like this is something with soft pads kind of padding around me. And I hear it kind of go like a semicircle around me, and I'm just thinking, well, I'm pretty sure this is a bear. So I start making noise and be obnoxious. And I decide that, well, I don't know. I'm going to get on. I got on my leather gloves and I had a little 2-inch pocket knife. I got that out and I got my little mag light flashlight.
Mini mag.
Got my little mini mag. And I'm trying to be obnoxious and,
You got the light turned on?
Yeah, I got my headlamp and I got my little mini mag. So I'm trying to be obnoxious. I got no trees to climb. I'm in this brush patch that's just like literally I can't even stick my arms out without just hit brush. I'm just in brush. Mm. And it kind of then – so I'm making lots of noise. And all of a sudden I hear this chick-a-chick-a-chick-a-chick-a-chick. Sounds like something climbing a tree. A couple things climbing a tree. And I hear these soft pads continue to kind of do a whole circle around me. You know, I can hear it all the way around me. And all of a sudden and the brush is shaking right in front of me. And I'm just I'm screaming, throwing stuff, you know. And but I don't see what it is. It, you know, I hear it back off and then does another complete circle around me. And then it comes at me again. I can hear it chase it's coming out again. And this time the bear's head pops out of the brush right in front of me. And I am just screaming bloody murder. And I take my Maglite and I just smack that thing right on the bridge of the nose. That Maglite, like full hammer fist, like boom, right on the bridge of its nose. And it didn't like that. It backed off. And then it went back to the tree, I assume. And I hear chick-a-chick-a-chick-a-chick. I'm pretty sure it's two cubs coming down to the tree. And I hear them all run off. But
wow.
Yes.
So you, Becca Spring, pounded a sow bear in the face with a mini Maglite.
I do have to qualify, though. These Oregon Coast bears can be very tiny, and it was not a big sow. I had to.
It was a bear.
Yeah.
I did have to kind of bend over to hammer fist it on the nose.
Becca, what kind of vocalizations was that bear doing? Was it growling or popping?
It was popping its teeth. Absolutely popping its teeth.
I mean,
yeah.
It was lunging at. I mean, if it was within arm's reach of you, it wasn't just like.
No,
bluffing.
It was popping its teeth the whole way. And just like, it circled me. It just couldn't catch my wind. It had no idea what it was. What
really?
I was. You know, I think
why
that's
couldn't
what
it catch your wind if it was, I mean, maybe the.
It was so oppressive. I don't know. You know, I guess I don't know.
Thermals
maybe,
were going up
and
or something?
Maybe this is my assumption.
So it just didn't know what
it
you were.
Been, thermals would have been going up. I mean, it was more than.
But you're yelling at it, screaming at it.
Yeah, picking up brush, whatever I could grab to kind of throw and, you know, just be totally obnoxious. But
and that's crazy, man.
This area she was working in is a state forest, but there's areas that are inaccessible, and there's a lot of bears there, very high density of bears.
Yeah.
And there's bears that have never seen a person. I mean, I've had experiences, never anything close to that, but a bear doesn't know what you are.
Man.
You know, and they're curious. And but that's my favorite story. And people are like, well, you know, tell me about your wife. I'm terrified of her. She'll punch a charging bear. I mean.
Okay. Now, what you said before, though, was that you had a knife in one hand and a Maglite, and you chose the Maglite.
Well, I had this pathetic, for whatever reason, I don't know how to knife fight. I had this switchblade in, well, not, well, like, what do you call it? Folding knife. A little teeny 2-inch blade. I had put that in my left hand for some reason. I had this Maglite in my right hand. I'm right hand dominant. I don't know.
Okay, no, I think it makes sense. I think, like, blunt force trauma, like, in that moment might be better than, like, having to have, like, a strategic stab. I mean, I kind of get it. That's incredible. Yeah. There's very, very few people in all the bear hunting circles that I run in. I mean, very few people are actually attacked by a bear. Or would get in, and I mean, I don't know
if that was an attack. It was.
I would quantify that as an attack if you were within arm's reach and had to punch it. I mean, that didn't like get you on the ground and try to eat you, but
no, I could have taken it. It was like I said, not a very big sow, but
I had several years ago in Arkansas. We were baiting bears, and I had about a 125-pound bear. That came up to the bait while we were there and kind of ran us off the bait. And I had seven or eight year old son with me. And this bear is just like right here. And I can't remember how it exactly went down, but I think I said, "Hey, watch this, son." And I start like trying to see how close I can get to this bear. And I get about like 5 or 6 yards from it. And all of a sudden, I jumped back, and I had the same thought as you, Becca. I was like, I could take this bear. and then I get about 5 or 6 yards from it, and I immediately jump back to my coon hunting past of how a 15-pound raccoon is the most vicious critter on the planet and will eat your lunch. And I was like, there was like this equation, and I was like, oh, this is a 125-pound raccoon. Mm-hmm. And it, like, all of a sudden, like, I was just like, respect. And I turned around and went back. And I was just like, son, don't mess with bears.
Well, you know, I do have to say that video of your bear, Saskatchewan, I believe, the one that came
yeah.
around. I mean, Becca was watching that, and she screamed, punch it!
Punch it, yeah. Where's your mag light? Where's still, your mini mag light?
I still have that mag light. That's good luck, man.
Oh, man.
Still works, too.
Well, thanks so much for having us on here, Clay.
Heck, my pleasure. You know, I wish we had more time. We would, like, because there's 100 things we could talk about. We could do a whole other podcast. But closing thoughts, both of you, either on records or on whatever.
I'm just super thrilled for you. I'm just excited for you. I'm glad that you came out here again. I'm glad you guys had a great time. And I'm just totally excited.
Well, this is, we're excited too. We're going home heavy.
Nice.
Going home heavy back to Arkansas tomorrow. Thank you, guys.
Yep.
And keep the wild places wild, because that's where the bears live.
Nice.